Hunter S. Thompson said, if every deadhead in Florida had voted, the world would be a different place.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Andy Bernstein is the longtime executive director of Headcount. Headcount is a very successful nonpartisan organization dedicated to voter registration and to inspiring participation in democracy through the power of music. They work with numerous well-known artists to drive music fans towards political engagement. The organization has thousands of volunteers who contribute hundreds of hours to the cause over the course of a year. When you listen to Andy, you see that he has a great story and is very committed to improving our democracy. I thought we had a great conversation. So first our sponsor, then my interview with Andy at Headcount.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is G-R-A-P-H-I-C-A-C-Y.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Andy, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. I'm Andy Bernstein. I'm the executive director of Headcount, which is a 16-year-old voter registration and turnout organization. I spent the early part of my professional career as a journalist covering sports and sports business. And I also wrote a series of books about the rock group Phish. And that led me into starting Headcount, which is focused on voter registration and engagement through concerts and music.
That is not a traditional path into the world of politics, and made me quite interested to talk to you about how this all happened. And 16 years in one place doing something like this is pretty notable. Would you mind just giving me a little bit more about kind of where you grew up and how you got into the journalism business in the first place?
Sure. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, before it was cool.
My dad's from Brooklyn, so yeah.
A lot of America came from Brooklyn. I got into journalism because I love the sport of hockey. When I was in college, I was the radio announcer for the Brown University hockey team and covered the team for the student newspaper. And then when I got out of school, really my goal was to work in the world of hockey. And I tried that for like a year. I had some of the most menial jobs you can have. I worked at Madison Square Garden taking people's season ticket orders over the phone. And then I got a job covering actually the sporting goods business for a trade magazine, and it was my first real job. That led to a solid career for the first decade of my professional life. I ended up at a magazine called Sports Business Journal, which is like kind of the Billboard or Variety for sports, a magazine that I was one of the founding reporters at, and it's still going strong. We started in 1997. I was there for 8 years. And while I was there is when I started Headcount. When Headcount started, it was a completely volunteer thing, side thing. It was late 2003, and I was actually doing an interview with somebody. And just an offhanded remark turned into a conversation about Guantanamo Bay and how messed up it was that the United States of America was putting people in jail without any charges, without lawyers and all of those things. When I hung up the phone, this was a normal standard interview that I would do all the time. But when I hung up the phone, I kind of had this moment where I just sort of sat there and blankly stared at my computer and said, I got to do something. I got to stop yelling at the television and do something. The first idea I had is maybe I'll volunteer for the John Edwards campaign. And that was a really bad idea. And I'm glad that I did not go for my first idea. And my second idea was, well, what if I get people to vote who go to the same concerts I do? Maybe this is a sphere of influence I have in the world. And I emailed a buddy of mine, Mark Brownstein, who is in a band called the Disco Biscuits. And I sent him this long email of all the ideas I had. And he responded with two words, "I'm in." And we started Headcount from there.
Those two words, "I'm in," are some of my favorite words. I have some friends who use exactly that expression. And it's always the best thing when you're kind of first mover to have that second mover saying something like that. I noted on your LinkedIn that you worked, quote unquote, as a troublemaker for New York PIRG. And that is really often a introduction to the world of talking to people about politics in a certain way, not exactly politics, but policy and stuff. And I wondered if that was influential with you at all.
You know, I'm so glad you asked that. It's a question I never get asked. And it's one of the reasons I was looking forward to doing this podcast, because I do a lot of music-oriented podcasts, and I knew it would be a kind of different conversation. You know, the PIRGs are just a great place to start. And so many organizers and people of note, including Barack Obama, came through the PIRGs at one time or another. And I worked for New York PIRG, which is independent from the rest of the PIRGs. But that is a proving ground and a place where people really cut their teeth. And when you canvass, which is what I did, which is knocking on doors and asking for money, you have to basically get that 30-second pitch down and know how to read people and sell people on an idea and sell people on making the world a better place. A lot of people hate canvassing. Most people who try it don't last more than a couple days and will tell you it's one of the worst experiences of their lives. Walking up to complete strangers and asking for money is like a nightmare you wake up from. But I really loved it. I loved the challenge of it. I loved how your success was directly quantifiable each night. I really enjoyed the atmosphere. And I worked with some of the most brilliant people that I'd ever met. The people who were running that operation, one of them, Martin Brennan, is, I think, the chief of staff for Chuck Schumer. Everybody I worked with there went on to do really meaningful things. So it was a very good experience for me personally, professionally. And then when Headcount got more serious and we realized we needed an office, this was in 2008, our second presidential cycle, the New York PIRG actually donated office space to us. We were at 9 Murray Street for a couple of years. It was a really nice kind of welcome back. So I have a lot of gratitude for the PIRGs. I definitely recommend that experience for those who can hack it. It would be amazing to know just how many people in the DC world or the progressive infrastructure came through the PIRGs, because it's a ton. It's like thousands and thousands.
Yeah, I spent one summer when I was in college with my brother in Colorado PIRG, and I remember just being terrified for the first times I would go up to people's doors. I'm not sure why it was so nerve-wracking, but I didn't know what I was doing. And by the end of the summer, it was a very competitive sport. I learned to not just follow the rap, but just like you said, read people. And I also started to learn a lot about neighborhoods, how you can sort of tell the politics quite a bit by the way the lawn looks or the type of car that's parked in front or what the street looks like. And that was really a big learning experience for me. And so was sort of the whole environment of working 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. at night and things like that.
You know, it's so true what you're saying about the lawn and the neighborhood. And one of my things I knew is if I came to the door and someone was watching Jeopardy, I knew I was going to get a contribution. If someone was watching Wheel of Fortune, I knew it wasn't happening.
What was the weirdest thing that happened to you when you came to a door? Because for me, two doors stood out over all those many, many I did. One was the House of Birds, where I opened the door and there was like, I don't know, 300 birds looking at me, including a huge parrot, right? Like 2 feet away and kind of freaky. And another was just like one of these places where there was trash about a yard deep and a naked lady lying on the couch looking highly disreputable. And it was kind of a weird situation for a 16-year-old to see.
Well, did she make a donation?
That's the key question. I think that I chickened out and turned on my heel.
You know, I don't remember any like bizarre doors, as we would call them. I remember the 2 to 10 lifestyle being fantastic. And this is what I tell young people. It's like, if you want a job where you're surrounded by other young people, and then you can go out after work and drink till 4 in the morning.
Exactly.
And then sleep an entire night and come to work the next day and be fine. Canvassing is the job for you. And I really do have very fond memories of that. That probably had a serious like party vibe. One of my real memories of it, my introduction to it, was my very first day, the day that I was supposed to start and train, I actually got arrested. I got arrested on a subway train for interfering when a cop was harassing a young black man. It was a long played out thing, but basically I landed myself in jail. This was 1990 when things like that happened in New York City all the time. And they still do. It was a very tense time in New York City at that era. So I get out, and Thursday nights for NYPERG is party night. And so I'm like, I got to go. I mean, if I've ever wanted a party, it's tonight. I've been sitting in jail all day. I go to this party night, and everybody knew what had happened. My friend was on the train with me, and he told everyone. So I was kind of the new guy, but people wanted to meet the new guy. And one of the bosses comes up to me, and he tells me about a Supreme Court decision called Houston versus Hill, which basically says that you can say anything to a police officer. A police officer cannot arrest you for what you say to them. I ended up going to the library, photocopying this decision, bringing it to the American Civil Liberties Union, and the ACLU defended me. I didn't have to pay for a lawyer. I got a pro bono lawyer. Obviously, the charges were dropped, but it was like NYPERG party night was where I got my legal advice.
You mentioned that it was a really, would have been a really bad idea to go volunteer for John Edwards. Was that because he later was revealed as not the most upstanding person, or because the road into partisan politics and that world was, would have been the wrong one for you? Why did you say that?
Yeah, it's both. I mean, the punchline is obviously that anybody who signed on for the Edwards campaign made a mistake because of turned out what he really was. But for me, partisan politics never would have worked. I'm not really a partisan. Like I'm certainly, you know, people can probably guess what my politics are. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, and I run a voter registration organization. You can probably guess where I fall, but I'm not somebody who is trying to advance the goals of the Democratic Party. I'm not somebody who believes necessarily that most partisan politics are upholding the ideals that they supposedly stand for. I believe in the value of democracy. I believe in the value of participation, and that when certain communities are well represented at the polls, then the arc bends in the right direction, or the arc bends toward the values those communities espouse. And for me, it was the live concert community. It was the festival community, what people would call the jam band community. I'd written a book about fish. So that's where I was coming from this idealistic belief that if the world were like a festival, it would be a better place. And when I saw things that were really upsetting me, as I did in 2003, that the most idealistic thing I could do was try to counter this awful direction the world was taking with the basic values that I believed in, which were love thy neighbor, the golden rule, and participate, make your voice heard. And I saw a community that I was part of that probably had a lot of people who were liberal but lazy or just really disaffected. People who had probably had a lot to say and a lot of strong beliefs, but weren't doing a whole lot about it. And so our thinking, myself and Mark Brownstein, my co-conspirator, was who are we to tell people who to vote for? Who are we to tell people where they should land on an issue? Nobody needs us to do that. That is not something we're going to appoint ourselves the ability to do. But if we can organize and make it easy for people to vote, if we can make it a value in the community that you vote, like one of the phrases that one of our volunteers came up with that was great was, but do you vote, bro? Like, And that phrase, like, we put that on a button and it said it. You could almost like picture the conversation that leads up to that. You know, you have so many people who have a lot of things they're not happy with in the world. And unfortunately, many of those people, especially in the year 2000, which had the lowest voter turnout ever for a presidential election, those people had opted out. They were like, oh, the system sucks. The candidates suck, et cetera. And they weren't participating. And Hunter S. Thompson said, if every deadhead in Florida had voted, the world would be a different place. And that was a real rallying cry for us. The idea that let's get our community going. We don't need to tell people who to vote for and who not to vote for. We can have a general sense of who this is going to benefit, but that's not the reason to do it. The reason to do it is much more values-based, that if our community is well represented, one thing, we're contributing to the world, and also the world starts to look a little more like us over time.
What was it about that particular group, Fish, misspelled with the PH, obviously, that attracted you enough to be writing a series of books about it?
Well, you know, anybody who is a Fish fan, that answer is like, you know, it's Fish is a life-changing thing. When you hear the first notes of Fish, you are hearing the soundtrack of your soul. You are, Fish is a very adventurous band. For those who don't know Fish, they are an improvisational band. Every show is different. Every song is different, played differently each time. They're musical geniuses, and they're also very much about community. When you're a Fish fan, you are part of something much bigger. You don't just listen to the music. The real Fish fan, as those in the community know it, is like Fish touches your life. You're generally, most Fish fans, many, many of their friends are Fish fans. It's where you find your people and find your home. There's also just a lot of folklore with Fish and a lot of humor and a lot of inside information. So I teamed up with my friend Lockhart Steele, who I went to college with. I was a little older than Locke. And Locke is this very brilliant guy. He doesn't just have a fantastic name. He also has now a fantastic resume. He was the managing editor at Gawker, and then he went on to start Curbed and Eater and sold those companies to Vox for a very healthy sum. So I had the good fortune of, long before any of that happened, my writing partner was this, you know, someone who was going to go on to succeed greatly in the blogosphere and the media world. And he and I and a couple other friends, we just kind of wanted to tell the story of Fish through our wacky lens. And that included statistics and research and also storytelling. And we ended up doing 6 volumes of it and sold 70,000 copies. So it was quite a little venture we had.
I mean, he sounds like an entrepreneur, but I think that anyone who founds an organization like Headcount and takes it for a decade and a half growing and doing new things is also an entrepreneur. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got that going and what the arc of that nonprofit's been like for you?
Sure. And you're exactly right. I mean, it's an entirely entrepreneurial thing, as was our Fish book, which is called The Farmer's Almanac. You know, The Farmer's Almanac was, we
with a PH, right?
With a PH, of course. We were self-published. We were, you know, we started in the parking lot and then moved up to hippie stores and eventually were in bookstores. And the trajectory of Headcount was very, very similar. We started with an idea, no money, no experience. We just got a bunch of friends together and a bunch of strangers together and started building this thing. And at the very beginning, we had a few bands that we were working with. Michael Fronte and Spearhead, Government Mule, the Disco Biscuits, Derek Truck's band, Leftover Salmon. I think those were the initial ones. These are like jam bands. These are like not huge names. These are bands that were playing clubs, maybe small theaters, but definitely not like mainstream acts. And the band Mo also. And very early on, one of the guys in Mo, Al Schneer, who joined our board, reached out to Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead, and Bob got involved. And when Bob got involved, we definitely had something going. We really didn't know what we were doing at all, but we had this vision that when bands go on tour, we would set up voter registration drives at the various cities they visited by having volunteer street teams at each city. And that was the idea. And when we started really figuring out how to do it, we knew we needed kind of like a computer system. And so somebody posted on a message board, a Disco Biscuits message board, what we needed. And sure enough, some guy comes out of nowhere and says, I'll build this whole thing for you. And this gentleman named Jay Carvin built an entire volunteer organizing backend system that was totally proprietary, built on our exact needs. And then we put out a word that we were looking for volunteers. And I think the first day, like 350 people volunteered, which seemed like a huge number. Now we have over 40,000. But at the time, we were like so thrilled that 350 people signed up. And we started designating people as team leaders and getting supplies out to them and figuring it out all as we went. While we all had full-time jobs, I was working as a journalist. None of us was getting paid. Meanwhile, years later, I talked to Jay about it, and we talked about the original build he did. And he's like, yeah, I'm not really a developer or a programmer. I'd never done anything like that before. I just like kind of like looked at a textbook and like figured out how to do it. And it blew my mind because this was our tech guy. He was self-taught. He was more of a web designer is what I learned. It was that kind of thing, that kind of spirit. I was like, if we don't know how to do it, let's just figure it out.
Did you stay on his software? Did you ever move on to, I don't know, more commercial backbone?
No, we've stayed with it. Now, we've built it, rebuilt it three or four times, and he didn't do this. He built the first two or three versions. And then another entrepreneur, a guy named Mark Jablonowski, who now runs DS Political, he built the next version. And then we just redid it this year and built a better version. So I guess we're on 4.0 now. But the functionality has never changed. Like the first ideas that we had at the beginning of the organization, it's still how we work. We've made it better. We've made it more user friendly. We've added bells and whistles. But the way we like organize, when somebody visits headcount.org and signs up to volunteer, they're asked about their metropolitan area. That's one of the questions, and then they go into a database, and then we have a team leader who has access to the local metropolitan area database and could send an email out about upcoming events and concerts when concerts were a thing, which obviously this year we've had to pivot. But the original idea still works. It's still at the core of Headcount. And it got built by a stoner who had never built anything like it before and just was very brilliant and figured out how to do it.
One of the crazy things that keeps happening to me in this podcast is Mark Jablonowski was a guest on the podcast a while ago. And when I see people intersecting, I realize how small a world it is of registering voters and political technology of different sorts. It's crazy.
And the real small world is that the reason I know Mark Jablonowski is because we have lake houses on the same lake. It has nothing to do with the whole progressive digital world. It's just a kind of coincidence.
But working for you is probably a stepping stone for him towards where he is now.
I think that would be giving us a lot of credit. You know, when he was like 21 years old, he was the chief technology officer of the inauguration. So I will not claim credit for his great career, but I will say that we all like feed each other. Like I've learned a lot from Mark. Probably Mark has learned a few things from me. And we're both in a different place than we were when we met. Headcount has grown a lot. DS Political has been incredibly successful. In that regard, like, you know, you build each other up.
How would you characterize the size and impact of Headcount now?
Well, from an impact standpoint, so our goal going into this election was to register 200,000 voters for this cycle and directly engage 1 million. And as we sit here today, I don't know when this will run, but mid-September, we are 3/4 toward our goal. And most years are about half the voter reg we bring in comes in the weeks right before the deadline. So I think we're going to do really well. And to have done it without any concerts is a really gratifying feeling, both on the voter reg side, but also on the voter engagement side. Like we want to have 1 million different Americans take at least one action with Headcount that helps them vote. And that can be requesting an absentee ballot through our website or searching for their polling place or verifying their voter registration, which is incredibly important. We've had over 100,000 people do through our website this year. So like from an impact standpoint, we're definitely reaching our goals. Well, I'd say definitely. I mean, we still have a ways to go, but I'm feeling very good about it. We've grown a lot. Our full-time staff right now is 25 people. We have a lot of agencies we're working with, a lot of contractors. That'll come down a little bit after the election. But for me, that feels really big. I'm a grassroots guy. And most of the years of headcount, the 15 years, well, we were three in 2008. In 2015, we expanded greatly and we're up to six. So the last 5 years, we've grown much more than we did in the previous 10. And that's been really exciting. And I just feel like we're much more capable now of doing more. And we've had a couple really exciting things happen this year that I think bode well for the future, because I'd really love to say, you know, I'd love to register 1 million voters. I'd love to get 5 million people using our tools. And there are organizations that are more digitally focused that have done that, vote.org being a very obvious one. Deb Cleaver's amazing work getting that started. So I think there's still a lot of room for growth for us. We're very different than them in that we're not creating technologies. We're more using technologies. And what we're doing that's unique is bringing in the musicians and the partners and the volunteer apparatus to go out and talk to people either face-to-face or through our emissaries who are the ambassadors, who are the musicians talking to their fans. And that's sort of headcount's niche in the voter mobilization space, is that we're not a technology provider. We're not a traditional progressive org. We're a music org. We're an entertainment and culture organization that's harnessing the great power that entertainment and culture have and driving it towards civic participation.
You mentioned some exciting things this year. What are you referring to?
Well, the big one is our partnership with Global Citizen. So Global Citizen is just an amazing story. And this guy, Hugh Evans, who's the founder, he's somebody who as a teenager in Australia went on a trip and was shocked by the poverty that he saw. And he made it his life's mission to eradicate extreme poverty in the world, which if you just think about it is a really powerful idea. It's not saying eradicate poverty. I mean, that would be wonderful, but that's a really, really hard thing to do. He's saying eradicate extreme poverty. And if you think about it, that is 100% achievable thing. When you think about the amount of wealth in the world and the disparities, that people having the basic things to live is doable. The money's there. It's just a question of how the world functions. So Hugh started this organization, Global Citizen, with that being its mission. And one of the things they did was they put on concerts in Central Park where fans could attend for free if they took certain actions online. And this was spectacularly successful. And from day one, he had the biggest artists in the world playing this event in Central Park. And we would go and register voters. And I was always really struck by the audience there, how young it was, how diverse it was, and how open they were to the message and to voting and all these things. It was like, it really was fishing in a barrel for us. It was like, all like 21-year-old kids who had just taken all these neat actions online to get to see this concert, which had this wonderful, uplifting, pro-social message. And of course, they wanted to register to vote. So we'd always had this really good experience with Global Citizen. And then kind of out of nowhere, I get a call not too long ago during the pandemic from Hugh, who I'd never met personally. And Hugh's a really big thinker. And he just had this vision of Headcount and Global Citizen aligning in a way that was very meaningful. His analogy was the Red Campaign and the One Campaign, which are separate organizations, and they have their own P&Ls and their own boards and things like that, but they work together. They have different missions, but aligned missions. And the mission of Global Citizen very much aligns with the mission of Headcount, because the only way to have big policy change in the world is when people are participating. The decision makers, and whether that's, you know, world leaders, elected officials, corporate CEOs, when the decision makers are hearing from the public in a meaningful way. So what Global Citizen wants to achieve in the world and what Headcount wants to achieve in the world, while they are different, they are naturally aligned. So Hugh came to us with this very big vision, and here we are a few months later. We've launched an incredible campaign called Just Vote that has Taylor Swift and Billie Eilish and our board member Bob Weir and our supporter Dave Matthews. And they're offering
different like fan experiences to get people to check their voter registration status. Same kind of formula that we've been using, but on a bigger stage with great technology and great marketing support. And this is going to be the first of many things we do together. And when I talk about a goal of 1 million registrations for the next cycle, or, you know, 5 million people taking action, you know, those are just numbers. I don't know what our reasonable goals are, but I feel emboldened to think big because we have a very big thinking organization now on our side. And it's just really exciting.
It seems to me, for someone who got going as a journalist following music and sports, that to have the chance to have these kind of relationships as part of your career must be a kind of a continual high. Is that right?
Yeah, sure. But I tell you, like, you know, people ask me all the time, like, are you friends with the rock stars? It's like the rock stars have plenty of people to be friends with who are probably way more rock star friend material than I am. You know, I'm very honored to know Bob Weir in the way that I do, who's just a really wonderful human being and a very warm person and a very egoless person. And I very much enjoy the relationships I have within the core music scene. And the one that I probably cherish the most is with my board chair, Pete Shapiro. Pete Shapiro is a guy who's done amazing things in his life. He put on the Earth Day concerts that were on the Mall in D.C. for several years. He put on the Grateful Dead reunion shows. He used to own a club called the Wetlands in New York that was an activism hub as well as a music club. And Pete's been a board member from day one and is our board chair now. And for me, like, being really close with Pete is a wonderful life treat. He calls me 3 times a day, and here's a guy who's running, he runs major music clubs that are now, you know, on mothballs. And he calls me 3 times a day just to talk about how we can get the vote out. And whether a pandemic or no pandemic, that's always the relationship. It's never about his business. It's never about how he can make money. It's all about how we can change the world together. So for me, that's a real high that I have this relationship with this collaborator. I go to a lot of concerts. I go to a lot of festivals. I get some wonderful access and things like that. But for me, that really is work. Like, that's my job. The treat, the pleasures, you know, the most pleasurable thing is it's watching young people develop professionally. Headcount, we have a very good internship program. We treat our interns, we treat them like family, is what I like to say. And we really put a lot of emphasis on people learning and just treating people like people. Not like, hey, go get me coffee, but hey, here's something we're working on. Let's work on it together. And so I've had the pleasure of watching some of our interns and our volunteers grow and become kind of major professionals. And there are a few people who came through Headcount who now have pretty big jobs in the music space, some in the political and nonprofit space, but mostly in the music space. And that's really cool. Like, when I can actually call on people who I'm 10 years older than, which now isn't that much of a difference. One of our very first interns and one of the very first people we hired is now like a top talent buyer at AEG Presents, the big concert promoter who we work with. And it's just so cool. Like, this guy who I know that his early professional life was under the wing of Headcount, and I value this person a lot and what he contributed. And to now see him be this super respected industry professional, that's the high for me. That has always been something that's really, really been meaningful. And just the entrepreneurial aspect, the ability to every day kind of unlock new things. We're prepping right now for National Voter Registration Day, which is huge for us. And every year we approach it differently. And every year we modify how we're working with artists and our social media game plan. And that's just such a, you know, my brain, I've never had a boring day at work. And I'm lucky I have a team around me that's taking on almost everything except the hardest, most thinky, and most nuanced stuff. And so I get to live in that world all day. It's challenging. It leaves you exhausted, but it also leaves you really gratified. So for me, that's a much bigger deal than getting to be backstage at a concert where, honestly, like, nobody's that excited to have me backstage. I'm being hard on myself. I have a lot of wonderful friends in the music world. It's not like, hey, here's the voting guy. Woo! You know, it's it's the authentic personal relationships I have, which are with some of the musicians and the people who I've kind of grown up with in this world. That, to me, is a bigger deal than getting to meet a big performer or be backstage at a concert.
That answer rings really true to me. As someone who built a company myself some years ago, the relationships I have with employees that continue to this day as friendships are, you know, it's not a lot terribly more important in my life. What advice would you give to someone running an enterprise about how to make the culture of a company or nonprofit in a humane way that you're talking about, in a way that values people's growth and yet accomplishes the mission at the same time?
Well, I do have an answer to that question that I've told people. I said, there are the two most important things you can do as an executive director. The second most important thing you can do is write really good reference letters for people. When somebody comes through as an intern, as an unpaid college intern, and donates their time, or they're a volunteer, or they're a young employee, take the time to write a good letter, a letter that you would notice as an employer, or if it's a grad school recommendation or things like that. Take that task really seriously and be creative. Get that person noticed, because that person worked really hard for you, and take their career path seriously. That's an important moment of their lives. Make it an important moment of yours. And the most important thing you can do as an executive director is send flowers when somebody loses a loved one. It really is. It is the most essential thing you can do. People will appreciate it. They don't always expect it. And it actually means a lot. And it creates a culture. I'm not a perfect boss by any means, but I think every employee, I'd like to think everybody at Headcount knows that I care. And when they see somebody down in any way, I think they know that I'm going to take the time to try to do what I can to lift them up. And that creates a culture, that creates trust. And you're doing it first and foremost for the person, but there is a management ethos that will help you, you know, that will help you run a campaign, help you run a company when the people around you see that you recognize people's humanity. And I would say that to anybody. These are the most important things. You'll register more voters, you'll raise more money, all the KPIs that you care about. If you do those two things, they will be lifted by them if you take that ethos. And it's fairly direct. When people know you care, and when people know that their future is part of your priorities too, because they've seen you do it for other people, when they know that their family and you can say family first and understand work-life balance, even when people are working their asses off. Our staff works very, very hard, and I expect them to work very, very hard. But I like to think that everybody knows I also know where the end point is, and that family and their lives and their personal satisfaction is still a very important part of the equation.
You referenced something like 40,000 volunteers. What do they do?
They register voters at concerts for the most part, and also a lot of community events. About in a non-pandemic year, about 20% of what we do are community events. But our volunteers, they're trained to walk up to somebody, a complete stranger, and say, "Are you registered to vote at your current address?" And then work them through the voter registration process, or get them to sign a pledge to vote, or a pledge to get three friends to vote, as vote tripling is called. Thousands and thousands of people have had the Headcount volunteer experience, and it's a shame. You know, the biggest shame of the pandemic were the individual volunteers who didn't get to go to the Dead & Company shows and the Billie Eilish shows and all these things. You can be a regular volunteer and do it once, or as often as you want, and you can sign up on headcount.org and pick out different events. Right now, the things we have for people to volunteer at are largely phone banking, text message phone banking, and also some community events, especially in a few battleground states where we still have people on the ground. But in a normal year, people can go to concerts. They get to see the concert for free. We always warn people it's hard work. Registering voters, you have to deal with a ton of rejection. But for those who excel at it, there's a lot of opportunities. And we have team leaders who are kind of running the show in each city. And then our outstanding team leaders are invited to go on tours where they're actually on a tour bus and embedded on a tour with the musicians. And we'll do that for big tours like Dead & Company or Billie Eilish or Ariana Grande, Panic at the Disco. So there's a lot of opportunities within Headcount where you can cut your teeth and get started. And if you excel, you can really work your way up. We're always looking for talent. We're looking for people who are good in the field, responsible, reliable, energetic. And for people like that, like Headcount is a proving ground and it's a very rewarding place. And I think that post-pandemic, like, it's going to be a new group. It usually kind of regenerates after each presidential election. So when we get back out there, which hopefully is soon, I don't know when it is, we're going to be doing very big volunteer recruitment. And I want people to know that, like, the opportunity with Headcount is always there. Like, if people are good at what they do, if they can register voters enthusiastically, if they believe in the mission, then we'll keep on giving them bigger and better and more exciting opportunities. And some of those young people that I've talked about that I referenced before, that's been the fun. It's like we have somebody on our team, Katrina, who started out as a regular volunteer, then became an intern. And now she's gone on tour with Ariana Grande, with Billie Eilish. She did the Vans Warped Tour and Dead & Company. So she's done four different artists. And she's just somebody who has this wonderful ability and skill where she can, like, go on a tour and create this whole series of activations that are traveling all over America. It's just really fun to see. And the whole volunteer culture of Headcount is really cool. Like, it's very much all ages. Like, we're targeting young voters. Our volunteers tend to be every age. And what they all have in common is that we're all young at heart. So we have people who are in their 50s who hang out with people in their 20s, and it's just not weird. Like, we do retreats and things like that. We all have this different commonality that is ageless. Like, if you love music and you care about democracy and you're, like, outgoing and put your energy into it, it doesn't matter how old you are. You're going to have something in common with another person who feels that way. So we do these retreats for our team leaders, which are getting bigger and bigger. The last one, we had to rent out an entire hotel. And they're really wonderful. They're wonderful people. There's just this incredible energy that's part of the Headcount volunteer experience.
When the pandemic hit and took offline all this live music, it must have been quite disruptive to you. How did you manage that change?
Well, it was disruptive, but I think of it as disruptive in the way that dot-comers use the word disruptive as a positive thing. It gave us an opportunity to focus entirely on digital and reinvent ourselves. I knew kind of early on that this was going to work well. Like, when we're out at concerts, there's so much of a focus on the events and the festivals and the logistics and cleaning up a dirty and wet tent that came back from a festival that it's sometimes hard to think really outside the box or the box we've created for ourselves. We were perceived as a field organization. We're perceived as a concert-based organization. And I always felt we were more than that. I felt we had good social media presence and some good digital ideas. And so we just leaned in. And there were a few things we did that worked really well. We created this, we worked with Phone to Action to create a platform where people could enter a contest by checking their voter registration status, which we'd never done before. And we've done like 60 of them now. I mean, we've done none of these. It was just an idea. We didn't even have a technology to do it with when COVID hit. And within a few weeks, we were out there. I think we did our first one with Sophie Tucker, who's an awesome and very supportive artist. And then we did a really big one with Camila Cabello and Dave Matthews and Phish. Phish actually had the most successful one. We did a festival challenge where 30 different festivals ran these contests for VIP tickets for the next year's festival. It just worked. And the other thing that worked was that our artists were just out there saying, register to vote at headcount.org. And they were reaching people who might not otherwise be reached, who aren't being reached by campaigns, who aren't on a million progressive organizations' email lists. And it was slow in April and May, but by June, we ended up having our best June ever in terms of voter edge, best July ever, best August ever, and we're well on our way to having our best September ever. The partnerships have been a big part of that. Spotify came on as a big partner. Global Citizen, who I mentioned, almost the entire music industry is partnered with Headcount now, from the Grammys to SoundCloud to ASCAP to Atlantic Records, Eventbrite, the ticketing platform. And, you know, we've tried a ton of different digital things, and some of them have failed miserably, you know, but we just don't stop. We just keep on trying everything and pushing our partners hard to use every digital channel they have. We're really blessed. Like the team at Headcount, they worked so hard during such challenging times. And for one thing, we had four people on our staff get COVID. You know, we're New York City based, and a lot of young people in New York got COVID from roommates and things like that. So right as this was hitting, and our staff, everybody who got COVID got like really sick. Even though they were young, they all got really sick. Luckily, they're all fine. It's a real thing. Like they're still having like some issues with it, at least one of our staff members. So we had this staff that was, you know, suddenly thrown into a very different situation, several of them getting sick, and they just worked their tails off. And they were just so creative. We had hired a new digital director. Most of the people who work at Headcount were all kind of self-taught. They were former interns, and we just figured out everything on our own. And we made a hire this year, a woman named Elise Granada, who had a little more experience than everybody else. And Elise just crushed it. I mean, just absolutely crushed it. And then we had this partnership team that has brought on like 20 corporate partners that are actually helping fund the organization. And then a whole bunch more that are more like media partners. There were real heroics. There were real heroics that happened in a very trying time. And, you know, I think we'll hit our goals this year. I think that we'll feel like we had a very positive impact.
When you talk about registering a couple hundred thousand people, I mean, it's a very large number compared to, you know, the number of people I've registered, which might be a few, but it's also a very, very small number compared to the number of people who ought to have been registered across the country.
That's so true.
And a lot of the reason that it's a small number is that this whole registration system is pretty artificial, and it's kind of a blocker between a person and their vote. Do you think about getting involved, or are you involved in advocating policy changes that would diminish the need for the kind of work you do and get more people registered and get more people voting?
Yeah, and we definitely support automatic voter registration, which ostensibly puts us out of business. It's a good thing. Voter registration shouldn't exist. It's a needless bureaucratic layer that doesn't really do anything for anyone. Automatic voter registration is what makes sense. And, you know, I think part of it, though, voter suppression is very real. And I'm particularly concerned about vote by mail and ballots not being counted. That's kind of the opposite of the Trump concern. I'm not concerned about an overcount and fraud. I'm concerned about an undercount and rejection and suppression. But I'll also say this. So much of this is about intent, and don't let it fool you. The reason that people don't register to vote is because they don't want to, not because it's too hard. If that was the only reason, then we'd register thousands of people at every concert because we make it really easy. You know, we know that when we go to a concert, that probably if it's young people, probably half the people aren't registered. If it's an older, more, you know, educated crowd, just demographically, the stats tell us it's a much higher number. But we're still reaching a ton of unregistered people who are walking by our booth and basically saying they don't care and not interested. So much of this is about intent. And we know that more people didn't vote in 2016 than voted for either Clinton or Trump. So the non-voters were the ones who determined the election. The non-voters won and everybody else lost. And, you know, so I think that there are systemic things here, some of which have to do with the systems, but some of which has to do with the psychology of America and how politics are perceived and how democratic participation is perceived and how the candidates are perceived. And if we look at where we're at now, I mean, the enthusiasm gap on the left is striking. You know, here in what everyone would agree is the most important election of our lifetime, you have a candidate that is just unquestionably, it's a quantifiable fact that the base of voters aren't excited about. And so when that's going on, it makes our job really hard. And it's why we have to fight for 200,000. You know, it's a number we're proud of, but it's barely a drop in the bucket compared to the 100 million Americans who don't vote. And, you know, we are just on the edges of that, just making slight inroads. But I think that the movement as a whole, all the groups together, I think it becomes meaningful. I think the technology providers like TurboVote and Vote.org and Rock the Vote have done a very important job. I think they can do better. I think that these technologies, the online voter registration, third-party technologies can advance a lot, and I hope that we'll see a lot of advances in the next cycle, because I'm really disappointed with where we are, because we're not really anywhere we were 8 years ago, and that's ridiculous. I think our movement as a whole has done a good job. As a movement, we're much better than 8 years ago. The technology side needs to catch up to where we are as a movement. But ultimately, we've got to figure out the psychology of 100 million people. And the Knight Foundation did a great study that people should read called the 100 million study. And it asked people who don't vote why they don't vote. And that is a very important national conversation to be having. Not just why it's important to vote, but why people don't vote. And I think the ability to listen, which I feel the left is really bad at. The left tends to believe in its own ideals and doesn't really want to hear people who don't share those values. And I think we need to get to a point where we can start hearing the non-voter and really figuring out, just like at Madison Avenue, an advertising agency would try to figure out why people aren't buying a product and get them to buy the product. We need better ways, more sophisticated ways to get non-voting Americans to buy the product of democracy.
One would hope that when it's really on the ballot, this would be a year where people would be voting for their self-interest in that way. You mentioned along the way a number of these other sort of organizations in your bailiwick, TurboVote, Rock the Vote, Vote.org. Deborah's gone on to do Vote America. And there's, I don't know, the Voter Participation Center. There's a bunch of different places. Who else do you see out there that is doing good work? And what, if any, gaps do you see in the space?
Well, I think you've named the key players, and Voter Participation Center is really has set the standard over the years. You know, you don't hear about them in the news a lot, but they're really a terrific organization, very data-driven organization. I think the world of Deb Cleaver, and it's certainly for the insiders of the progressive world, seeing that story play out with her going from Vote.org and then starting her own thing. It's interesting, and anybody who knows Deb and her sense of humor, it's just like, it's hard not to be intrigued by everything that's gone on. But I'm a big Deb fan, and I think that, you know, ultimately a little bit of the left eating itself is all too common. And and for those who don't know what we're talking about here, Deb started an amazing organization, Vote.org, that people probably are familiar with. And very publicly, the board of Vote.org removed her. The good news is I think Vote.org is thriving, and Deb's new organization, Vote America, is doing great work. And it's incredible to see the creativity and the ability to kind of reinvent oneself all the time. So I have a lot of respect for all those players. We also really like a for-profit organization, which is Phone to Action. And we use a lot of their technology, and we found that to be really important. Ballot Ready is another one that's doing a really good job, and I think very well respected. So I think the leaders in our movement on the technology side have done a really good job. I miss the Bus Federation. They're not around anymore. They became a new organization that is doing a great job, but is just really different. The Bus Federation was this very quirky, creative group out of the Pacific Northwest, where they did things like dress up as bunny rabbits and run around college campuses and register voters. And that's the stuff we're missing. I think we're missing the creativity, the spark. Years ago, there was somebody put out a website that was called Where's My Fucking Polling Place? And it was just using a simple API to create a polling place search, but by naming it Where's My Fucking Polling Place, I got millions of people to use it. And it came out like 2 days before the election. And I think that the creative spark has been missing. The other organization that I would call out that had it was March for Our Lives. I mean, what those kids, what the Parkland students accomplished in 2018 is incredible, because it actually affected voting patterns, and there is data to prove it. There were like surveys that proved that people who didn't otherwise going to vote voted because of the work of the Parkland students. And we need more of those. And those guys have gone on to college. And I think that organization is still doing very well with different leadership. One of the leaders is on our board now, Matt Deitch, who may be the smartest dude I've ever talked to in my life. So we need more people like that. We need creative young people. We need kids in their teens and their early 20s telling old guys like me how to do our jobs, because I was a young voter when Headcount started. I was in my very early 30s. And now I am very much not in the demographic we're trying to reach. And I'm the first to admit that I don't know what really true young voters value. And I don't pretend to. I'm just smart enough to have really good interns who can tell me what to say. So I'd like to see more of that in our community, more groups bubbling up from the true grassroots now that you have this more established infrastructure that's out there.
Is there a question that I haven't asked that you'd love to answer?
Not really. I think we've covered a lot of ground. I don't know anything about your podcast. So I was excited to do it because I thought it would be different than all the others I do. But can you just tell me a little bit more and kind of how long you've been doing it? I literally know nothing.
Well, I think it's over 3 years now. It's over 500 episodes now. And most of the founders of the groups that you've mentioned, Phone to Action, Ballot Ready, Deborah at vote.org, and the woman who ousted her, and Paige Gardner, who runs the Vote Participation Center, all of them have been on. I do talk to people in a couple different areas. One is progressive leaders who are running progressive groups or really are part of the Democratic Party or the independent groups that are sort of part of that coalition, and then nonpartisan people who are kind of fighting for the democracy without a partisan slant, and then academics and reporters and other thought leaders that are following what's going on there. Another area is sort of the entrepreneurs that are making companies a lot of times in political technology to help progressive organizations do better. So people like the Jablonowskis of the world and many others. I don't know, you said Vote Tripling. There's a guy with a group called Vote Tripling. We had him on. There's just tons and tons of experiments and efforts and institutions being built trying to deal with a lot of the problems that we have. And I'm just really interested in the people who have that passion and who are, you know, moving us forward in a time where, you know, there's other forces that I think are trying to take us in other directions that are quite scary to me.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'm glad to know these others have been on, and I'm glad to know somebody's paying attention to our little world. And I'm sure your listeners are people of influence and people who care about this stuff. I'm not really that much a part of that world. I mean, I certainly know all the people that you just said.
And that's part of why I was interested to talk to you, because, you know, when you list out a whole bunch of bands, I'm almost 55. If you said Talking Heads, I'd know. But I only know Billie Eilish because my daughter.
I did two conversations today, one with you and one with David Byrne. That was fun, too. We did a Zoom thing where it's going to get produced and be part of the promotion for the film of his show.
He's a super interesting guy.
Oh, he's the best.
He's the like one of the few of these sort of people I've actually met, because he did a fundraiser for the elementary school that my daughter went to, the public school in my neighborhood, because his sister had a kid there, I think. And so he was in the house next door, gave his kind of TED talk about how different concert venues produce different types of music. And I've just been a fan of his since I was at Coburg.
Yeah, he's been very supportive of us, and it's been a really nice relationship. Well, I'm very glad to have done this. It's fun.
That was Andy Bernstein. Andy's at headcount.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com, greatbattlefield.com, or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.